From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
A federal court says Florida's redrawn North Florida congressional district is okay, but that doesn't mean the matter's closed.
When the judicial and legislative branches cede power to a zealous executive, we all have to be worried.
Also this week, Governor DeSantis signs the bill banning younger teens from accessing social media, and it looks like that's not a done deal either.
I don't believe it passes the constitutional muster of the First Amendment.
We'll also serve up a heaping helping of controversy regarding meat made in the laboratory, and Florida turns to an old form of preparing workers for employment in order to meet stubborn personnel problems. I'm Tom Flanagan, online and on air. This is Capitol Report. A federal three-judge panel has upheld Florida's congressional map after finding no constitutional problems with the state's removal of an African-American performing district. But as Valerie Crowder tells us, the broader legal fight over the map isn't over.
Governor Ron DeSantis signed his own congressional map into law after rejecting the legislature's bipartisan plan that would have preserved African-American voting power in North Florida 2 years ago. At a press conference Thursday, DeSantis defended his past actions.
We were right in 2022 to veto the map. We were right to sign the revised map. And we were right when we said that they would be upheld in the courts as being constitutional. And so that's just where we are 2 years later.
Following a trial last fall, a U.S. District Court in Tallahassee this week found no evidence showing that the state legislature had acted with racially discriminatory intent when voting to pass the governor's map. Michael Lee is a redistricting legal expert with New York University's Brennan Center for Justice. Lee says he's read the court's roughly 100-page ruling a couple times since it was issued Wednesday.
The governor is very much a part of the legislative process, and yet the court seemed to take the governor almost wholly out of it. It only matters what happens within the two chambers of the Florida legislature.
The governor's map removed former Congressional District 5, which stretched from Gadsden County to eastern Duval County, and favored Democrats. The legislature at first attempted to preserve the district until the governor got involved. The lead plaintiff in the federal lawsuit in Florida is Common Cause, a nonpartisan nonprofit that aims to protect democracy. Vice President of Programs Kathy Fung described the federal district court's decision as dangerous.
We're concerned that this is how tyranny takes root. When the judicial and legislative branches cede power to a zealous executive, we all have to be worried.
Fung says a lot of the evidence that could have been used to show racially discriminatory intent was never presented. She says that includes text messages, emails, witness testimony, and other evidence that could have shed light on conversations that were happening behind the scenes as Republican state lawmakers were working with the governor's office to pass a map.
The legislature was able to hide all of its conversations that it might have had behind closed doors about what the reasons were for adopting the maps. And as a result, the court did not find that they had direct evidence of racial discrimination.
Fung says they're still deciding whether they'll appeal the federal district court's ruling. For now, she says she's hoping for a better outcome from a state challenge that's before the Florida Supreme Court.
Racial and partisan gerrymandering are illegal in the state of Florida. We are hopeful that the state case will give voters justice and see the lines be redrawn so that Black voters are not denied the right to full representation.
The state Supreme Court will likely hear arguments in that case this summer. I'm Valerie Crowder in Tallahassee.
A new Florida law that could result in some kids getting booted from social media platforms is raising questions about whether it will actually work. Adrian Andrews spoke with a tech expert and lawyer to understand how and whether Florida can enforce its law and the chances of it holding up in court.
Governor Ron DeSantis calls Florida's social media minor ban one of the strictest in the nation. The measure was passed to keep kids off apps like TikTok and Snapchat in an effort to protect their mental health. In doing so, Florida's new law aims to prohibit anyone under 13 from having an account.
One of the things that I know a lot of parents have had concerns about is the role that the internet and social media play in the upbringing of young kids.
But there are still many unanswered questions, like how can social media companies verify someone's age? How will the state even know if sites are checking for that sort of thing? And what about the First Amendment? According to the law, the age verification process must be anonymous and should be handled by a third-party company. But the verifier can't use someone's personal information, like a credit card or driver's license. Jason Frankovitz, a computer scientist and software engineer out of California, says Florida's language should be a bit more specific, especially if it wants to crack down on kids using online platforms.
They basically say, some age verification process that's based in the United States that is in the business of providing age verification. So there's some wiggle room there for them to come up with something that is going to be most suitable to help enforce this law.
Frankovitz believes the legislature will have trouble enforcing a social media ban because the law applies only to companies that target specific audiences. According to the law's text, if apps have a percentage of kids spending at least 2 hours per day on them, as well as those that have addictive features such as infinite scrolling, the company will have to comply with the law or face penalties up to $50,000. Frankovitz argues the state will probably never see that money because companies won't easily hand over information about the demographics and trends of their users.
How many users are accessing which of these features and what types of content is being used on those features and the demographic breakdown of the users who are adding that content when using those features during this time of day, only the internal technical people within the company really have access to that data.
Other states like Arkansas and California have seen their social media regulations temporarily blocked by the U.S. Supreme Court, and big tech companies have said they'll sue Florida on free speech grounds.
This is what's called a prior restraint on speech, which is even a greater burden.
Timothy Shields is an attorney in Fort Lauderdale. He represents software companies and social media influencers. He believes the state will face legal pushback for reasons other than First Amendment concerns. He points to the section of the law that allows 14 and 15-year-olds to keep their accounts with parental consent.
The two gap years where they can be online with parental approval also raises some constitutional questions about if this is harmful. You know, we typically don't allow harm to be waived by parental consent.
Earlier this month, the governor vetoed a similar measure after it received pushback from parental rights and free speech advocates. Florida Attorney General Ashley Moody and other state officials support the law. They say social media companies are, quote, manipulating Florida's youth with addictive features. I'm Adrian Andrews.
The state and Disney settled lawsuits this week over who controls design and construction at Disney World. They stem from a 2023 bill replacing the Disney-controlled Reedy Creek Improvement District with a board appointed by the governor and state senate. The new board then sued Disney over development plans approved before Reedy Creek's dissolution. Skylar Swisher has been covering the dispute for the Orlando Sentinel, and speaking today on the Florida Roundup, Swisher said the settlement came as a surprise.
Disney settled with the district, and they agreed to just declare those development agreements void and go back to the 2020 plan, and any changes to the development plans would have to be consulted with Disney, so now they're saying they're going to be working together collaboratively.
Disney lost a federal suit against the state earlier this year and had appealed the judge's ruling. That appeal is being put on hold, and Disney will drop two other state lawsuits against the district once the settlement is finalized. Coming up on Capitol Report, Florida acts to ban synthesized meat. That battle's continuing.
Should Florida ban the sale of a product that the FDA has already said is safe to consume?
One of Florida's U.S. senators returns from Israel with strong criticism for the Biden administration.
Whether Hamas is destroyed and whether Hajjis are back, that's basically what the United States abstained from. That makes no sense.
And some advocacy groups are pushing Florida to rejoin a system that's supposed to ensure no voters cast ballots in more than one state. Several states are considering banning lab-grown meat for consumption, and Florida could become the first to do it. Backers of cultivating meat say it's friendlier to the planet and the animals that form the backbone of the world's meat supply. But opponents say lab-grown meat isn't real and say they're safeguarding the future. Lynn Hatter takes a look at exactly what lab-grown meat is, isn't, and why Florida and some other states want it outlawed.
This is really banning something more akin to Frankenstein meat. It's not only yucky, but it's the stuff of potential dietary nightmares.
Republican Representative Dean Black's family has been raising cattle in Florida since the 1800s, and he's not impressed by cultivated meat products, which he frames as otherworldly and unnatural. Florida lawmakers approved a wide-ranging measure that, among other things, bans the product from being sold for consumption in the state. But just like the Frankenstein monster in Mary Shelley's classic novel, Paul Shapiro argues the product is being misunderstood.
Nobody is arguing that cultivated meat is going to be literally identical to meat from slaughtered animals. That is not necessarily the goal. There are plenty of foods that a member of the Florida state legislature might think they don't want to eat themselves, or they might prefer something else to it. But the question here is, should Florida ban the sale of a product that the FDA has already said is safe to consume?
Shapiro is CEO of the company Better Meat Co. and has even authored a book on the future of foods. Lab-grown meat is drawn from cells of a single animal, grafted onto some sort of lattice-like structure, and then multiplied until it resembles the muscle tissue of animals, which we commonly identify as meat. Chicken nuggets, steak, pork chops, you get the idea. Critics of cultivated meat argue it doesn't carry the same nutritional ingredients as natural products. Backers of the product say it doesn't carry the same harmful pathogens that cause foodborne illnesses. Shapiro argues Florida's law is anti-competition.
And the reason they want to do this has nothing to do with protecting consumers from confusion. It's nothing to do with nutrition. It has to do with protecting cattlemen from competition.
So which side is right? Is lab-grown meat less nutritious, as critics argue? Or is natural meat more dangerous, as its proponents claim? Well, turns out maybe both are true.
So that means we can significantly reduce the risk of foodborne illness caused by food pathogens, such as E. coli or Salmonella.
Dr. Quinshin Rao is a food science researcher and professor at Florida State University. He says with lab-grown meat, fewer animals need to be slaughtered, less land is needed to raise them, and it can increase the supply of meat that will be needed to support growing populations. But he also acknowledges that, aside from protein, other naturally occurring minerals and vitamins in animal-farmed meat would have to be added in to the cultivated product. Conversely, it also means harmful things wouldn't. And there are drawbacks. Cultivated meat is expensive and energy intensive to produce right now because there aren't the large-scale technologies available to produce it in mass. Regulatory hurdles also remain. But the biggest challenge Rao sees to cultivated meat is whether people are willing to try it. And the results of a 2023 study published in the academic journal Trends of Cognitive Science suggest lab meat has a long way to go before it lands on most dinner plates.
So based on this study, okay, they just published not that long ago. So UK, US, the overall general population acceptance rate is about 40%. Mm-hmm. When I mentioned this one, after this lecture with my undergrad students, only 50%. Of my students willing to try such kind of product.
During a recent visit to a local farmer's market in Tallahassee, few people were willing to give the product a go.
When I think of lab-grown meat, I think of Spam, basically.
Lavinia Bergen is an organic farmer and runs Bluefish Farms near the Florida-Georgia line. While cultivated meat does not appeal to her, she does not believe the state should ban it for others.
I think the market
should take care of itself. I think if people want the lab-grown meat, let them try it if they want it. And then let them decide.
I think it's a good step in looking out for the people and educating them.
Kelly Cogswell runs Paradise Farms in Tallahassee. The farm provides poultry like chickens and turkeys. The animals are kept in a pasture, the small ones in pens, and all are fed organic food and eat worms and other grubs they catch. Cogswell is skeptical of cultivated meat. He sees Florida's cultivated meat consumption ban as a preventative measure.
I think it's a good step in looking out for the people and educating them. I think that it should get a lot of people's attention and make them pay a little bit more attention to what they're eating and what not only big agriculture but big business, the food industries in general, are putting in front of the consumer to eat.
Wired.com recently noted that large-scale meat packers like Tyson and Cargill have invested in lab-grown meat companies. Paul Shapiro of the Better Meat Company thinks Florida is just delaying the inevitable.
The future can be bright for American entrepreneurship if we allow entrepreneurs to have the ability to innovate.
But that can't happen if states try to slow it down, he argues. Meanwhile, Governor Ron DeSantis has final say over whether to ban the sale and consumption of cultivated meat in the state. I'm Len Hatter.
Senator Rick Scott has returned from his sixth trip to Israel. Tristan Wood reports that this trip comes days after Israeli leaders were angered by the U.S. allowing the United Nations Security Council to pass a resolution calling for a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas.
The United States had the power to veto the resolution, but abstained from the vote. In response, Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu pulled an Israeli delegation from meeting in Washington. Days later, Scott went to visit Israel. Netanyahu told the senator during his visit that he believes the resolution will embolden Hamas.
And that therefore my decision not to send the delegation to Washington in the wake of that resolution was a message to Hamas. It was a message first and foremost to Hamas. Don't bet on this pressure. It's not going to work. And I hope they got the message.
During a press conference back in Florida, Scott said the U.S. abstaining from the resolution was the wrong move. This audio is courtesy of Wink News.
I think everybody would like a ceasefire the day after Hamas is destroyed, okay? But to say you want a ceasefire whether Hamas is destroyed and whether hostages are back, that's basically what the United States abstained from, that makes no sense. And I think it sent completely wrong message to Israel.
Scott's decision to take the step to visit Netanyahu during such a politically contentious time could have electoral implications, says University of South Florida political science professor emerita Susan McManus. She says it may impact his current reelection race.
When you are facing a U.S. Senate race, and you're a U.S. senator, and you understand the ability to access a foreign leader like Netanyahu, you put that as part of your calculus into running for a statewide office. And it is clear that this could be a tighter race than the presidential race. At least that's what polls are showing right now.
Current public polling in his race has primarily been paid for by Democrat-leaning sources. Those polls show him leading by 3 to 5 points. McManus says his visit could help consolidate support among some Jewish Floridians and pro-Israel Floridians, but could turn others away from him.
There are Jewish people who feel very strongly that Netanyahu should be removed. There are those who think he's doing a great job and keep him in. So obviously Senator Scott is aligning himself more with those who feel like that Netanyahu needs to be supported by the U.S. and the U.N.
The current Israel-Hamas war started after a Hamas attack in Israel killed over 1,000 people. Since then, the Gaza Health Ministry reports over 30,000 people have been killed in Gaza, mostly women and children. Recent polling by Gallup suggests the majority of Americans disapprove of Israel's military action in Gaza. It found most of the shifting opinion has come amongst Democrats and independents. I'm Tristan Wood.
Florida's unemployment rate was 3.1% in February for the third consecutive month. That's higher than a year ago, but still relatively very low, as many companies continue to face a shortage of workers. So businesses along with the state are getting creative in recruiting and developing talent. Florida's growing apprenticeship program is helping with that, as we hear from Gina Jordan.
Before I got into this, I had gone through a pretty rough patch in my life, and this kind of gave me a good outlet.
Joey Gary is a project manager at Parker Services in Tallahassee. He's currently overseeing renovations at the Leon High School gym that involve a lot of pipe installation and welding.
My job as a project manager is to, you know, make sure they're following the prints, they're following the specifications, they're following all of the things that the contractor has laid out for us.
Gary is in an apprenticeship program through the Tallahassee Refrigeration and Air Conditioning Contractors Association. His program has him taking classes a couple of hours a week at Lively Technical College. He's been working with Parker Services for 6 years, but since starting the apprenticeship 3 years ago, paid for by the company, he's earned multiple certifications and raises. Now he's about to graduate.
This program's really given me, you know, a direction. You know, I'm married, I'm about to have my first kid, so I've come a long ways in, you know, a couple years.
Apprenticeships can be a way for companies to fill holes in certain skill areas.
We were looking for a way to attract talent and to retain talent, as well as provide our current employees an opportunity and a pathway with a little structure around it for growth.
That's Chris Oglesby, Vice President of GNS Fence in Tallahassee. His company registered with the state's apprenticeship program last June and created a curriculum. They now have 7 apprentices being paid for on-the-job training, including employees who jumped at the opportunity for advancement.
I've been pleasantly surprised that it's created a buzz within the organization from existing employees that have wanted to know more about it. Hey, what is this program I'm hearing about, and how can I get involved? And that, in my mind, gives them a structured path that they can follow with some very specific requirements and goals that they have to hit.
Florida has 365 registered apprenticeship and pre-apprenticeship programs through the Department of Education, and the number is growing.
We in the state of Florida have been challenged by the governor to make Florida number one in workforce education by 2030.
Adrian Johnston used to be the state's chief economist. Now she's president and CEO of Career Source Florida, a nonprofit organization that has 24 local boards and 100 career centers statewide. Career Source is funded by a combination of state and federal dollars, and it's administered by the Florida Department of Commerce. Johnston says the success of apprenticeship programs led to an initiative called Apprentice Florida.
That's a joint campaign for reaching out to businesses and job seekers alike. We also, through the Career Source Florida network, have started employing apprentice navigators. So each local area has a dedicated position to help both job seekers and employers develop apprenticeship programs that meet their needs.
Participants in the state-sanctioned apprenticeships are paid. Those who complete the program receive a certificate from the state with the goal of landing in a high-wage career. The latest apprenticeship report from the Florida Department of Education found that new graduates from the program have an average annual wage of nearly $54,000. I'm Gina Jordan.
If you'd like more information about Apprentice Florida, we have it for you on WFSU.org. You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, of course, on top of everything else we've been talking about, this is an election year, a presidential election year, no less. And in today's political environment, the simple act of casting a ballot has taken on complicated and controversial new ramifications. We started the show with a piece about a court battle regarding a congressional voting district, and we end with a story about Florida backing out of a national system that was supposed to help ensure election integrity. Florida belonged to the Electronic Voter Registration System, known as ERIC, for about 3 years. The system's considered highly accurate by elections professionals, but as Margie Menzel reports, last year Florida left, joining a small group of other deep red states. Now, an election watch group is trying to raise attention to the issue ahead of November.
Laurel Lee was Florida's Secretary of State when Governor Ron DeSantis steered Florida into ERIC. She was pleased that more than 4 million adults would receive postcards directing them to the state's online voter registration portal, relying on data from the Department of Highway Safety and Motor Vehicles.
In the coming weeks, we will be contacting those potentially eligible voters with a postcard. The estimate that we have is that this could be over 4 million.
At the time, DeSantis endorsed joining ERIC. The idea was to identify duplicate records and voters who had moved or passed away. ERIC allows states to securely share voter registration data across state lines and with other government agencies. That allows participating states to reach out to eligible voters who have moved to another state but not yet registered to vote. But last year, Florida withdrew from ERIC and cited the need for greater data privacy and less, quote, blatant partisanship. Here's Florida's current Secretary of State, Cord Byrd, discussing the state's decision to drop ERIC with Neil McCabe of the One America News Network last year.
There came a time when that was no longer tenable, and that we were very concerned with the protection and integrity of the data that we were entrusting with ERIC and the partisan nature of some of the individuals that are leading the organization.
Last year, Florida began entering into state-by-state agreements with Alabama, Georgia, Ohio, and West Virginia. Brad Ashwell is the Florida director of All Voting is Local, which supports ERIC. He says the two-state contracts are a problem because these states don't have similar standards.
You know, ERIC provided a consistency, provided quality control, provided privacy protections, and all of these things that were hashed out in the Florida legislature for years, developing statutes that would make sure that voters' info was safe. So now there's a million-dollar question of how Florida does that. What does it do to replace ERIC?
And while the states that have pulled out of ERIC are Republican-led, the elections professionals who swear by ERIC are bipartisan. Here's Georgia Republican Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger in an interview with WFSU last year.
Systems like ERIC are an important tool for election administrators and help prevent people from being registered in and trying to vote in multiple states. Any state that prioritizes politics over best practices and opts out of ERIC ahead of next year's presidential election actually runs the risk of having outdated voter rolls. If states are interested in strengthening elections, withdrawing from ERIC does just the opposite.
As to the question of bipartisanship, Ashwell points to the conspiracy-laden aftermath of the 2020 election and says ERIC is legitimately bipartisan, with all Florida's 67 supervisors of election in support.
And the truth is, you know, we all want to see clean voter rolls. We all want to see lists maintained as efficient for, you know, election officials and make sure the system's running well. And that's what ERIC did. Right now, it's the only tool that does that. It's very unfortunate that the state pulled out, and we're hoping to work with officials to make sure it doesn't enter into any of these other agreements or tools that are going to harm voters.
Voting advocates say they fear that election denial activists are now pushing their own ERIC alternatives that would make it easier to challenge the voting rights of thousands. I'm Margie Menzel.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Adrian Andrews, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. We hope you'll join us again next week on air and online for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.